on this episode of The Jason Wright Show.
And I found a box, a shoebox under my parents' bed that I had, only reason I didn't throw it away is it didn't fit in that last box I was taking to the dumpster. And I went back into the house and I was very sort of maudlin. My last time in the house that I'd only known growing up, and I started going through that shoebox, and I realized that it was a collection of letters that my mom had left behind, dating back to 1893. Anything else to say?
Well, Mark Lehman, I tell you what, man, this is exciting. All right, now we are recording. You're on. You're live. So behave yourself. No, I tell you what, I'm so excited not just to learn about this book that I've just read. That congratulations, it's going to go up a little bit on your units sold report because this is going to be a Christmas present for a number of people in my life. This is such, it's such a good book, but more than that. So real quick, audience, that when you listen, indulge me. I'm catching up with my dear friend of many years. For those who don't know, my first real venture into entrepreneurship was whenever I, at the ripe old age of 28, I purchased my first real estate brokerage in Tyler, Texas. And I soon got involved with what was then called the Texas Association of Realtors, and the chief lobbyist, vice president of governmental affairs, was today's guest, Mark Lehman. And he became a dear friend, just a guy that you always felt better when you'd been around him than you did before, even if you're already in a good mood. And so to be able to catch up with you today and to see you looking great and healthy, and now we're talking about a book you've written, Mark, it is so awesome to have you on the Jason Wright Show, brother.
Oh man, first of all, thank you for that nice introduction, but it's great to see you, my friend. I am a fan of your program and everything you ever write, so I'm really humbled to be on your program today.
Well, I appreciate it, and so we're here to talk about your book. That one, it's a genius idea, dude. I mean, I love stuff like this. Like I told you before we got on real quickly, you know, everyone has a family history. We all have a genealogy, and it's become really with, you know, all the different ancestry, what is it, ancestry.com or whatever it is, right. And, you know, 23andMe, you know, people are able to really dig back into their past in a way they never had before. But what you did, I think, is really cool in that I'll let you tell, how does this start this very, I'd say very unique. I'm a stickler about that. As a writer now, you know, nothing can be very unique. Either it's unique or not. It can't be very unique. You can't accentuate unique. But this is a unique way of looking at your family history. And then now everybody gets to see your history. But the cool thing about it is, Mark, is there's a little piece of all of us in everyone's history. So talk a little bit about how this whole thing began.
Sure. It wasn't the book that I had retired to write, but it was the one that publishers came calling on. But in 2017, I dismantled my parents' homestead. It was a homestead where they had lived almost all of my life. All but 3 years of my life. And the last day all the furniture was out of the house. I was exhausted. I carried the last box to the dumpster, and there was already a bulldozer sitting outside to tear the house down because we were going to sell it and close on it the next day, and they were going to tear down my parents' homestead. And I found a box, a shoebox under my parents' bed that I had, only reason I didn't throw it away is it didn't fit in that last box I was taking to the dumpster. And I went back into the house and I was very sort of maudlin. My last time in the house that I'd only known growing up. And I started going through that shoebox. And I realized that it was a collection of letters that my mom had left behind, dating back to 1893.
Wow.
And going up to almost the present. Since the house was vacant, I laid them across the living room floor. The only thing that was in the house at the time was a nice roaring fire and a bottle of wine and all of these letters. And I realized this is an amazing story of my life. But what really started as my original reason for writing a blog, this started as a blog, and what the original reason for writing it was, I noticed this was 2017, and the last letter in that shoebox was dated 1998. And I know people continue to communicate. A lot had happened in that decade since then. We had wars, we had 9/11, historic presidential elections, but nothing was written down. And I realized that's when people stopped writing. That's when people stopped, that's when they started using Snapchat and Facebook and emails and any other instant sort of communication. And those things aren't saved. And if we don't save our history, we lose something very rich. So that was the original reason for this blog, which became a book. But as I got into it, I found a much higher goal. And warts and all, everybody's family history is an amazing history. And it must be saved and it must be shared. And we're not doing that, especially when we quit writing things. We, you know, it's so easy to delete an email or throw away a Christmas card that's just kind of a glossy piece of paper or something. But you've got to figure out ways to save. So all the way through this book, there are different ways to make sure you preserve your written history, because your family history is something that needs to be celebrated. I thought I had the dullest family in the world, and I started reading how they dealt with massive crises through their lives, of depressions, of early pandemics, and many wars, and interracial marriages, and draft dodgers, and you name it. And I thought, this needs to be celebrated. This isn't something that's hidden.
Well, I tell you, one of the things that you really reinforced that I have done that, you know, I'm, and after reading your book, I'm so glad that whether it was divinely inspired or whatever, because I'm not the brightest guy out there, but when each
it was divinely inspired.
each of my girls, when they were born, I started journaling to them. And I started it with Rylan, the oldest, on the way, or right whenever we got to the hospital, I started writing to her.
Oh, wow.
And here's one of the main reasons, as they got older, this is where it became really valuable. I think one day they'll see is that they're going to have their account of the arguments that we've had, the ups, the downs, and there haven't been that many. I think it was on the podcast one time or somewhere, I was talking about how with each of them, they've both had their one big blow up with Dad. It's kind of funny. There's only one, and I guarantee you, if you were to ask them, what have you ever had a real argument with your dad, they would point to those two. But nevertheless, they're 20 and 21 years old, man. They're young adults. And so I have documented what I was thinking at different times when they were making decisions that I didn't want them to, you know, they were making what I thought was bad judgments. When I was so proud of them, when they had moved me to tears. And so in reading your book, it made me think, you know, thank God that I took the time to do that. Because here's the thing, and this is what I want you to talk about. Like you mentioned that, yes, there were some controversies and there were some warts in there, but if you have the writing, I'm sure there were just like Aunt Fred. We got to talk about Aunt Fred. She's just a stud. She was awesome. I mean, she was so awesome. But you know what? The cool thing is whenever I read, I want to take this story up. I'll just go ahead and tee this one up for you so you can talk a little bit about Aunt Fred. But my point I was making before I got to Aunt Fred was, you get to hear them in their words, right? You know, so often it's just kind of almost like folklore through the years. You know, we think we know our families. We think we know what kind of people they were. Some of them that you may have thought were just like, if you had never heard of Aunt Fred's heart whenever an interracial relationship came into your family at that time, if you hadn't heard her, you would never have, if you, you would have thought, oh my gosh, you know, if you didn't hear that story, you wouldn't know the other side of Aunt Fred, this tender side that was probably a heck of a lot more open-minded than the woman that was chasing, you know, pages of a dirty magazine across a playground. So with all those teasers and hints of me doing a terrible job of telling your story, tell us about, a little bit about Aunt Fred, and then to kind of weave all this together any way you want to, man.
Okay. Well, first of all, the stories of my aunt and uncle, who her name was Fred, his name was Fern. Always that the truth is much better than fiction. I mean, some of this stuff you cannot make up.
Yeah.
I was a Southern Baptist minister in numerous small South Texas congregations that was just a peripheral part of my life. But and with Aunt Fred's, all of her actions, and she was the original church lady. If anybody ever watched Saturday Night Live, and
yes.
I saw Dana Carvey come out as a church lady. I said, "Oh my God, he must have known Aunt Fred." I mean, she was the devoted preacher's wife, and she was fighting Satan at every turn. But unfortunately for her, she did send a lot of letters, and it's hard to throw away letters. When somebody writes something, you hate to just throw it away. And so
Right. Her
letters, unfortunately, were survived. I think the story you were talking about, I'll go ahead and clarify. For a while, she had the unfortunate nickname of the porn peddler of Pleasanton, Texas. And she found a very large cachet of Playboy magazines under her son's bed. And in rural Texas at that time, everybody had these big, giant 50-gallon burn barrels, is what they called them, where you burned all of your trash and everything. And Aunt Fred's burn barrel had a lot of things in life, many books that she banned from the library, and it wasn't good enough just to throw them away or whatever. She had to burn them. But so she, armed with a, and I can just see her doing this, armed with a can of kerosene and a stack of Playboy magazines, she headed to the burn barrel, and she started ripping off these pages of topless women and crude jokes and throwing them in the fire one by one. And this cachet was very large. So she had to make several trips back. And one time she forgot to put the wire covering over the barrel that kept all of the partially burned papers from floating out. And she came back. They'd all floated out, and unfortunately floated next door to the high school baseball field where the team had just taken the field for practice. So they got all a big kick out of it, and she was mortified. But it soon died down. But I have a feeling if it happened to somebody else, she would not have been as sympathetic as people were to her about the issue. But that was just one story of her. And, you know, Fred and Fern were weaved in and out throughout the book, because they wrote so many she wrote so many letters that were saved. And my editor, when I started publishing it, said, "So this is made up, isn't it?" And I said, "Oh, no, you can't be." He said, "I'm laying on the floor laughing, and I never laugh at anything." And you can't make that stuff up.
Well, okay, so you say something there that I really wanted to touch on with Aunt Fred, that were it not for her letters and the documentation of her behavior, you have to assume that, yeah, she probably would not have been as, you know, sympathetic to that happening to someone else. But then again, take us to just kind of give us a commentary on when an interracial relationship comes into the family. And look, and to the listener, you have to understand the era this was happening. And, you know, those people who think that they're the only virtuous people that have ever lived and can look back, you know, hundreds of years, and they would have been the one that did everything differently, may want to judge Aunt Fred for how she handled this and her thought process. But I thought it was pretty telling of her heart in that time and how she wanted to deal with this by loving this person. So kind of talk a little bit about that, Mark.
Right. Well, and that story was somewhat late in her letter writing career, because we had already gone through the Holocaust and World War II and a lot of other areas where she did comment on. But I did have a relative who lived in Pasadena, Texas, and his brothers and family were all very involved in the Houston Ship Channel. They were all sort of union dock workers and very proud of it. This cousin was trying to better himself and went into the Army, served in Korea without a scratch, served two terms in Korea. But when he got out, before he left the Army, he was going to go to college on the GI Bill. He had a motorcycle accident in Washington State and ended up in the hospital and fell madly in love with his nurse. And they got married and moved back to Pasadena, Texas. And the problem was, it was 1957. And people sometimes don't realize Texas is actually a little more progressive when it came to interracial marriages, because in most states, even north of the Mason-Dixon line, not most states, some states, interracial marriages were illegal at the time. They did get married. And by all accounts, including Aunt Fred's, everybody loved Hattie, the wife. And they all stood by Tim, my cousin Tim. And I will say, too, I put this letter, when I was originally writing the blog, I was putting letters associated with different times in history. It evolved past this, like Memorial Day and Christmas and Easter and Kristallnacht, which we had some Jewish members mm-hmm. in our family. So this was actually a subplot of a story I wrote celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, which was a holiday. And I've always been very proud of my family's dedication to civil rights. And I realized it all started with them all rallying around my cousin Tim and Hattie. Now, unfortunately, their life in Pasadena was not glorious. They ended up leaving to move to the Northeast, where they both were very successful in Detroit and produced the first college graduate in our family and the first elected official in our family. Aunt Fred wrote a letter to Tim's mother, and it was well-meaning. And of course, I hope your listeners do realize this was 1957.
Yeah.
And she wrote a letter saying, Fern and I have met Hattie, and she is absolutely lovely. We can see why Tim fell in love with her. I have a solution to your problem. And gosh, I hope I'm not offending someone. It's again, don't remember the time. She said, a lot of Negroes in our community are now ironing their hair. If she grew her hair long and dyed it blonde, and she's already very light skinned, she could pass as a white woman. And that was her solution to the problem. And she did also go put on a footnote, which I did look up, and this was actually gossip at the time. She said, after all, that is, they tell us that is what that Dinah Shore woman does.
Yeah.
So that was in the letter, that was in the book. And, Hattie and Tim both died fairly early, and their son sent me their letters, and Aunt Fred wrote her all her life. And I thought that was, it was well intended. But again, that's your family history that you need to celebrate.
Yeah.
And the way that Tim and Hattie were treated in the blue collar enclave outside of Houston where they live. One brother got in a big fight at a bar and ended up with a broken nose, and Tim realized that was the time they needed to leave town. But they were all, and still are to this day, because I've reconnected with them when writing the Shoebus Chronicles, pretty right-wing conservative people, but man, do they believe in civil rights. And part of our family history, which I'm very proud of, was in 1963. They marched with Dr. Martin Luther King in Houston, and it was a peaceful march, one of the last ones he did before he passed away. And their goal was to, the purpose of this march was to open up the Houston, and I did call the mayor of Houston, and he did reconfirm this history. The city hall had opened up a dining room or cafeteria inside their walls the taxpayers had paid for, and it was whites only.
Wow.
And so that was the purpose of this protest and this march. And and I'm very, first of all, I think that that was a very worthy cause, and I'm very thrilled that my family participated in that. And again, that's the type of history that we want to pass down, warts and all.
Yeah. No, that's one of the reasons why I wanted that to be a part of this conversation, is because, you know, in this day and age where everything is so, we want to think that the moment we're living in, that we have evolved perfectly. And this is, you know, like if you and I, with our mindset now, were plopped down in 1957, we would make all the right decisions as it relates to justice and equality and all this. And, you know, someone described at one time that, you know, when you really stop to go, oh, so if you were that one person in the crowd that disagreed with the entire crowd, you would be willing to risk your life? I mean, would you really, and have you done that? Have you done that in reality? And so the nuance of that story and kind of the challenges on both sides that came through, and then just seeing Aunt Fred's heart come through, and that not just for the love of Hattie, but also the love of her family, and realizing if you love her, I love her, and I love you. And in her, again, 1957 Southern Baptist in the South mind, trying to figure out a solution to make this work. I just thought it was, it's not a perfect story, but no story is, but it's a sweet story.
I think you're exactly right. And you know, Jason, this country has been very divided in this last year or more than ever over racial issues. And to me, that is still a growth process.
Yep.
And I think this shows, if you read it in the chronological order that mm-hmm. it was taken, that it's a very, I think it's, it helped us get us where we are today. And these are stories that need to be celebrated, yeah. not hidden, in Fred's case, not burned or something. Because it is a progression. And I think that's what is so important, no matter what. This starts out with a quote from Steve Jobs. It says, you've got to, the book does. And it was just a perfect quote you've got to go back and connect the dots of your life to know where you're going, to know where you are and know where you're going.
Yep.
And I think I'm beyond thrilled with how well the book has been received, and I'm getting a lot of comments and things. And I did put my home address and my personal cell phone on my Facebook page about the book, and not knowing anybody was actually going to read the book, and certainly not knowing it's become a bestseller, which I'm thrilled about that. But I think again, look at right now, look at this last year that we've dealt with and how that might play out in history books in the future. We've had the major Black Lives Matter campaign. We've had this unbelievable pandemic. We had an historical presidential election. We've had these huge issues in Afghanistan. That will be up to maybe one or two authors to show how those are going to be remembered in textbooks, and it may just be a paragraph or something. But I think it is so important for every family to know and to share with future generations, because they'll hear about that.
Yeah.
And this is how we dealt with this election, or this is how we saw this election, or this is how we felt like we were supporting this candidate who is being painted so horribly in history books. So Therefore, no matter what, I mean, it's hard to believe a lot of anything anymore when you watch the news or you look at, I think, I'm not here to bash the media, and that's not my goal at all. And they've certainly been great about publishing and helping me with this book. But are we going to let them tell the story, or we have to tell the story? And it's our family story of these issues, which is going to be the only right story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why that was what I was trying to accomplish with the Shoebox Chronicles.
Well, you know, and philosophically, as a way to archive history properly, you know, one of my favorite books, and it wasn't a book at all, it was just a journal, is Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, right? I mean, it was nothing more than his daily journal, and you get a glimpse into, at the time, the most powerful man in the world struggling with how to be a good leader, how to be a virtuous man, talking about slaves that he had and how they should be treated. You know, Seneca, you know, one of the other famous Stoics would talk about how to treat a slave. You know, and it's like, we couldn't even imagine, you know, having to let that be a part of our daily lives. So you have to go back and see what we've come from to put everything in context. And one of the things that an author that I've read a lot of that actually kind of pointed me towards Stoicism once said was that during the pandemic, when it first really started getting, you know, heated up, and all of a sudden we realized, okay, this is going to be, it's going to be global, and it's going to be a domestic issue that we're all going to have to deal with in one way or another. He started going back and reading books about other catastrophes, in particular pandemics that had happened, like the Spanish flu and those sorts of things, to read newspaper clippings and read what the leaders did and read what the commentary was, because the bottom line is, you know, history is always want to repeat itself, and there's nothing new under the sun. It just kind of changes and evolves as we go. So if you can kind of look to the history to understand, okay, well, how did they deal with this sort of issue? It really can put some good context into it. Now, I want to go back a little bit. There's a passage. I mean, I've got your book all marked up. There were so many little nuggets that I really liked. And there's one I'm going to try to remember to get back to this one little landing spot that I want to talk to you about, kind of because I think it's very apropos for where you are in your life. But whenever you were approached, well, first of all, just take us through how you go from finding the box of letters, spreading them out and reading them, and then you had never blogged or anything before that, had you? I mean, I know you had an idea you wanted to write after retirement, but how did that happen? What made you think? Because here's the thing that's funny, Mark, is that, like, I'm steeped in this whole writing process and all the kind of the best practice and everything. And most of, like, Tim Ferriss, Ryan Holiday, James Altucher, all these guys that have been very successful promoting their own brands, they'll tell you, do exactly what you did. Write a blog, make the blog rich in content, and those can be the chapters of what may one day be a book. If you are like, when I was 35 and I thought I was ready to write a book, which was so dumb, but I did it, and I'm glad I got it out there. But of course, the older I get, the worse that book gets. So, you know, that's the problem. You know,
like your old, like Aunt Fred's letters that come back to haunt you.
Exactly. It's like, God, you cocky. What you talk about the Dunning was it Dunning-Kruger effect in like full bore right there, thinking I knew way more than I did. But nevertheless, it's a good read if somebody, you know, for somebody. But, you know, instead of going right to writing a book, you know, take your time, start a journal, start a blog, and then start to piece it together. So how did that evolve for you? I mean, kind of take us through the process, and then getting into writing a book, man, it's a bear. It's not easy.
Oh, but I'll give you a real good tip on that. First of all, I had had a blog associated with Texas politics called In Layman's Terms, which I was trying to get
I forgot cut about that.
All of the clutter of...
I forgot about
which
that.
I actually, I never get angry, but I wrote it on a day when I was sort of angry. I was walking to the Capitol, as I do every day during session, and I saw a small group of people who were... supporting Second Amendment rights. Right. And they were off to the corner, and they had these big giant muskets and everything. And there were maybe five of them or something like that. Went into the Capitol. One of the more successful days I'd seen at the state legislature, because the state legislature has a way of kind of figuring out how to do things. But I came back home, and because I don't take my cell phone to the Capitol, I don't return text or anything like that. And was when I got back to my office, I get this, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? What is going on at the Capitol?" And I turn on the news, and they took those five people with their muskets and exercising their right to protest, and made it look like total anarchy. I mean, these guys, men and women, were just standing there very peacefully,
Right.
and it was not a story inside the Capitol or anything. So that's why I wrote, okay, in layman's terms, this is what's really going on. And so I had a blog experience, but the Shoebox Chronicles, when I realized there were some stories here, was going to be a very simple, probably life expectancy of maybe 10 blogs of why it's important to write things down and why it's important to save things that you've written. But other people started calling, and other relatives started sending in more letters and more things that just evolved. But here's how I got published. I retired a little bit earlier than a lot of people do, and from the most incredible job. People couldn't believe I gave that job up.
I couldn't, but, yeah.
But it was a great, great, great experience. I loved every day of it, but I realized, God, I really feel like this is not what you want me to do. But as I had basically a list of eight things I was going to write, from screenplays to novels, to nonfiction, to essays, and a few speeches here and there. Shoebox Chronicles wasn't in the list. But one very interesting day, and I knew it was sort of God divine, certainly the worst day of my life, which I'll digress just a minute. Very shortly into my retirement, I was kind of on top of a mountain of enjoying life and writing a little bit and going to happy hours and volunteering at the church and doing these things that I had never gotten to do before. But I was diagnosed with a stage 3 metastasized melanoma and spent most of the year at MD Anderson. But I was at home in Austin, Texas, in quarantine. And Austin, Texas was hit by a phenomenal ice storm this year, very historic. And we had layers and layers of ice, so I couldn't have gotten out to get help even if I wanted to. And I had some incredibly bad side effects of the treatment. They didn't last very long, but I thought, man, I cannot even move. I was actually just laying on the hallway of my upstairs, because that's as far as I could go, and I was praying to God. And I don't really, this has never happened to me, where you pray and all of a sudden, you know, there's a lightning bolt or something like that. But a little bit later, I get this call from a very well-known publisher, and which is actually the people that did not publish the book, but someone I was very familiar with. And he said, "I tell you, I'm just trolling blogs right now." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "You have a very, very large following of your blog." And I was aware of that. It wasn't people who were necessarily reading the blog that I put out of the Shoebox Chronicles, but they were forwarding it. To several really large churches. Rick Warren's church was publishing some of them. Purpose Driven Life, I'm sorry, that was Purpose Driven Life, but the Charles Stanley's blog, In Touch Ministries, had published some of them. And then the Veterans of Foreign War groups were just going on fire. So he said, "Have you ever thought about putting these stories in a book? Because you already have an immediate base." And so I thought, well, he wasn't called. He didn't care about the book or anything. He was just looking, said, "If you've got over 100,000 people viewing your blog, if you let us market a book to those people of the blog, they're going to buy it," which is why the, I do joke that I think it's kind of bragging that the book was the number one bestseller. I didn't clarify anything. It was number one bestseller for one day, because they pre-sold the book to the people who had they marketed to the blog people and said, "This will be available and you can get advanced purchase on the release date," which was August 8th. So on one day, they collected all those people who had responded and sold them the book. But So my point is, if you are interested in writing, as I was, and I had knocked on publishers' doors, I had sent things out, I had entered different contests, and was gotten great positive reinforcement, but no one wanted to publish anything I wrote. I wrote a blog, and all of a sudden the publishers are calling me. And so a good way of doing it. It's a good way of building your audience. And to be 1,000% honest, it's a good way of protecting of practicing your own craft of writing, because some of those early shoebox posts are living to haunt me because they were pretty bad. But by the time we got to the point where I was putting them in a book, and I had the privilege, I had the luxury of going back and rewriting some of those. For friends who do read the blog, only about 20% of the blog is actually in this book.
But see, that's the thing though, Mark. Everything you just described there are like James Altucher, who is one of my favorite podcasters, authors, thinkers. I mean, he's like a modern day Renaissance man. And he would tell you to do exactly what you did. And that's the reason why I started this podcast. When I decided to re-release, push play, and do an updated version of the book, I told my editor, I said, I want to start a podcast and a blog. I need to build an audience, because back whenever I wrote it the first time, it was, or the first edition was 2010. Well, social media wasn't what it was. Podcasts weren't even a thing. But now you have so many tools, and this is what I tell young entrepreneurs all the time that want to build a brand or do something of that nature. Right now, the gatekeepers, they're falling away. You can go directly to the market, and it's just using the tools at your disposal. And man, you executed on it exactly like all of these guys say. And there's two things that you really made me think of whenever you were telling that story. One of my favorite quotes ever, that was from Dave Grohl, the lead singer of Foo Fighters. Dave Grohl said, "If you do something well enough for long enough, someone will notice." And that's what you did. You practiced your craft. And another thing, talking about those early blogs and going, oh crap. But that's the deal, man. If you wait till you're, I guess it's Seth Godin that says that if you wait till you're ready to do something, you will never get started. You have to just start putting it out there, right?
Yeah, on that horrible day, I was not expecting to be, spend the end of that day putting together my first book, because I had a publisher who was ready to publish that next week. So, but I wish I'd read the book. I wish I'd heard all those ideas before I did it by trial and error. But you got to the same point.
Well, but here's the thing too that I think that you did, and so I'm writing a blog post right now about joy. I just got through reading, and I did a book review on C.S. Lewis's book. I think it's Surprised by Joy or something like that. And the point being that, C.S. Lewis, what he found out was pursuing joy for the sake of joy, you will never find it. It's not a thing. It's pursuing endeavors and pursuing life, being in the present, going full bore, then all of a sudden joy will sneak up on you because, right? I mean, that's what you just poured your heart into these letters and writing and the experience and having fun with it, not with no expectations. And then all of a sudden, the success sneaks up on you. Now, here's what I wanted to get back to. I'm so proud of myself that my ADHD mind did not lose my place, because this reminds me so much, man, of where you are. And you touched on it a little bit in your story. And the reason why this is important to me is I think creation, creating something, building something, making something, I think it is the single greatest cure for your health, for your mental health, physical health, whatever. When you can create something and stand back and look at it. But then there was a passage in the book, it's on page 104, that reads, "From my grandmother to my mother said, your father feels his purpose here on earth is over, and he is just a bother." Man, I get choked up to everyone now. Whew. I mean, how many men in particular, and I know we're not supposed to separate out men from the world these days, but how many men feel what your grandfather was feeling at that point where their utility value in this world, when they can no longer go off to work and lead the family and no one's coming to them for advice like they once did. And, you know, they feel this sense of listlessness. Well, you had your dream job. You were crushing it, which, what a bold move, man. Cause you did, you had a great job, dude. You had an awesome job.
I thanked God every minute I was at that job.
You were so good at it. It was just a great deal. And to step away because you felt like you were to move into something different. But how important has it been for you, especially, you touched on it, going through the cancer, you've left this great career you had, but by being creative and still pursuing, what has that done for you mentally and physically to overcome the battle that you're fighting right now with the cancer and those sorts of things? Just talk to the listener, because it may not be being a writer. It might be building birdhouses. Yeah. What has that meant to you?
It means a lot. And I want to make sure I answer correctly. The question has not been really asked in that way. And to me, it's so important. Well, it doesn't mean just mean a lot. It means everything. The cancer experience and I have to be real careful when I say this, because I've got a lot of friends going through it or have been going through it, or they're touched by a terrible, terrible tragedy. The cancer experience was the greatest, was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Because ultimately it got me where God wanted me to be. Yeah, I was kind of on a mountain. We were talking about the job, but leaving the job and everything, and ended up in a pretty big valley, and where it's just me and God. But as I talk to people constantly, and I will be in a cancer ward, soon as COVID lets me do this, or a waiting room, or anywhere I can go to visit with people who, in this particular case, or what, it doesn't matter what's going on in your life, but it's take whatever is bad in your life and take it and find something to channel what you're going through, whether it's just baking, whether it's volunteering, whether it's, you know, deciding to go back to school, whatever it is that you wanted, you've got to channel that. Of course, as you know, I'm very faith-based too. But you know, I think that all I'm doing, I mean, and I had bad cancer. I mean, I realize now how bad it was. I was just sort of living it. And, you know, my doctors I was down at MD Anderson, which is the best hospital I could go to for what I had. And they were, you know, gosh, I think we can get through this. I think you're okay. I think, you know, we're 50-50 here, but your attitude's going to make a big difference. Well, what made the difference was being able to channel. And they kept saying, God, you've got this incredible attitude. Well, I wasn't sitting there focused on that cancer every day and those god-awful reports and those scars and those painful side effects. I was focusing on something else. You know, and again, I thank God for it. I do. Well, I will say, every day, when I went in to sit down to write, and I did write every day, and there were days when I couldn't even walk. I mean, and it was quarantined, and, you know, so I couldn't get any people over here. I had an exercise band that I would swing around the leg of a bed, and had that, and I would use that to pull me to my laptop sometimes when I couldn't take that last two or three steps. So it was bad, but I always started, and I paraphrased Psalms 19, and which says, "Dear Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight." And I would say, "Dear Lord, may the words that I write be acceptable in your sight." And then just sat there for a while until I felt like I was in tune with the Lord, started writing. And that made cancer nothing. I mean, I never even thought about cancer anymore unless I had to go in for a treatment or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a belief and an attitude. But I want to share that with all of my cancer friends, and I've got a lot of them over this last year and a half of treatments. And and a lot of them are reading the book, and all the proceeds from the book right now are going to cancer research. I'm not taking any profits from this book. I think when God writes a book like that, you know, I basically was just there typing it. It's hard to take money from it, but if I could say anything, channel your, you know, none of us know how many more days we're going to have in this world, but when you're going through a major health crisis, you really don't know, and you're really questioning it. And if you're not going to follow a dream, then you're not going to follow it. And the second you start following your dream, it's the pretty much the only thing that's important in your life. I probably answered that way longer than you expected.
No.
It probably direction, but
no.
I apologize. I'm that's me.
Dude,
right now.
No, Mark, that's what I wanted, because look, you know, this show, I want it to be a force for helping people to see. I mean, I had no experience at this, and I had no idea that I would ever get the listenership that I currently enjoy. And like you, I don't do it for the money. I don't make any money off this podcast. I do this because I love to hear stories like yours, and I want to use this as a way to encourage people to go find something that will take your eye off the misery that might be around you, because we have enough people keeping an eye on the misery. Don't worry. There's plenty of people keeping a close watch on every freaking thing that is wrong. But man, I get to the good fortune of speaking to undergraduates at least a couple times a year, in particular at SFA, my undergrad alma mater. I'm not smart enough to go back and talk to the SMU guys where I went to graduate school, I guess, but SFA, they'll still claim me. And so I tell them, and they're a bit surprised at times because of what they hear in the news and what they see on television and in social media. And I say, you know what? This is the single greatest time of the human experience. If you're not excited about being alive right now, then you're in trouble, because it's never been this good. We have right. So many things that we can pursue, and it's not about money. And that's the thing too. It's like I said, you know, if you pursue money for money's sake, some people will crush it, but rarely will someone that pursues money and be materially successful also have peace, contentment, a loving family around them. That's not the case. It's those stories of the people that they just pursue something that gives them a passion. Then all of a sudden, the bad stuff sort of fades, and you never know. You just might end up having somebody go, hey, have you ever thought about writing a book that can be even more purposeful, where you can spread it and you can help with people that are in your situation? And that's the thing, man. That's why I wanted to go there with your story in particular, because it's not like you just were like, well, I'm retired, now what I do? And oh, look, because what your grandfather felt, that is a cancer of the soul that so many humans have when they feel like they're worthless, they have nothing left to offer. And what I want people to understand, what I'm so passionate about, because I've been through those valleys in my life. You know, whenever I lost my congressional race and I went through a divorce and I had sold my companies, I thought way too early, and I'm sitting there going, I'm on a shelf. I'm useless. You know, I was like 43 years old. And I'm like, I've hit my peak and now I'm on the downhill slide and I'm 43 years old. And man, I was wallowing in misery. And then I decided, you know what? No, I have incredible relationships, incredible friends. I love to communicate. I've got all these people who I can connect with and tell the story. And I started the podcast. I relaunched the book, and that, man, that brought me out of that mire and the muck of just doing. And so to hear you share that, brother, it's exactly why I wanted to bring that up now.
Oh, you had brought up real quickly.
Yeah, man.
You started this by that chapter, which is actually the shortest chapter in the book on wisdom. But it doesn't take long, you know, if it's not shared, it's, you know, it's the greatest gift in the world. But I'm surprised at the reaction that I'm getting from people who read the book. I thought they'd be commenting on Aunt Fred or some of the real dramatic stories in there. But so many people have said, man, I have started writing letters to my great grandchildren who are not even born. I had a friend just today. I ran into her when I was at the hospital. Said, yeah, I read your book and I went out and I bought this Bible, this journal Bible. And I'm writing shit. I hope I finish it before I die, but I'm journaling to my unborn grandchildren, my children, my unborn grandchildren, things that I'm thinking about or what this verse means to me to leave to them. So, and it was all based on that wisdom thing that I think the one of the quotes I used in there at, was Alex Haley said, you know, when a man dies, it's like a library burning down.
Yes.
Because they take all that wisdom with them.
That's right.
They don't even know they have it. We don't know we have it.
That's exactly right. And it's funny you say that because I just heard someone talking yesterday about this very thing, talking about how wisdom is in short supply. We've got all the knowledge that we want. We can go know a lot of stuff. Wikipedia, you could go to Wikipedia and learn more than Isaac Newton ever knew, right?
Yeah.
But what doesn't come with the knowledge is the wisdom. And that's what these stories bring with them, is that wisdom. They bring this wisdom into the present. What I want to give you the opportunity to do before we wrap this thing up, and this is just, I mean, I could go on all day with you, brother. This is so fun.
I'm loving it.
But I want you to pick one, two, as many as you want of the stories, and just tell the story to the audience that kind of sticks out, that's one of your pearls that really sticks out of the Shoebox Chronicles.
Oh, gosh, I'll do it. And
I know that's kind of like asking you to pick your favorite child.
But I love all these stories so much, and they have different meanings. I'll go to one of the darker because there's a lot of all of these had to be written based on actual letters. It was a shoebox chronicle. If there wasn't a letter attached to something, and a lot of times I had to go out and figure out I'd read something in a letter, and I think, okay, I've got to dig. And I blast the internet because it's stopped people from writing these type of things. But at the same time, I used it a lot and embraced it terribly to research some of these stories. But I'm going to talk about the story Question Authority. Mm. And there's several things in there of Celebration of the Written Word, which this book is, and Things That Are Left Behind. And in my mother's picture album, she had a picture of a cousin of mine, and it just said Rusty 1969. And I thought, gosh, I remember Rusty. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to share that, because this was, if people don't save their picture album, their photo albums, and write things down in them, like this, who this person was, or whatever, we're not going to remember who those people are decades from now, or a next generation. But in it, she said, all it was Rusty. I thought, gosh, I remember Rusty. He was about 8 or 9 years older than me and his mother and father, and he came to a couple of family reunions, and they just disappeared. And so I started researching and whatever happened to him, and I finally found that his mother, and it turned out that that photo taken on my parents' driveway was a, and what prompted me on the photo album. I had a friend that morning had sent a desperate message out. She accidentally deleted all of her cell phone photos, which had her first child's baby pictures in them. So she was saying, anybody that has a picture of our baby, please send to me because I've lost all of mine. Mm-hmm. So that was when I got into the whole photo album thing. But it turned out that picture was taken when Rusty went to North Texas State University, it's called the University of North Texas now. And the first year, spent most of his time protesting the Vietnam War, which a lot of people did at the time, and flunked out of school and got drafted. And that photo that my parents had was probably the first couple of days he was on the lam. And what struck me in the picture of his VW van that was loaded up with all kinds of, well, it was loaded to the gills with his personal effects, had a bumper sticker on that said question authority. To make a very long story short, he ultimately, as the law was closing in on him, ended up in Canada where he lived till the war was over and was ultimately pardoned. During this time, I had another cousin who was a graduate at A&M and done two tours of duty in Vietnam and had two Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star for bravery. And his father was serving in the Pentagon, and there was a lot of family discourse displayed in letters that I now have written back and forth during that time about these two children. As it turns out, and like I say, I think it's probably the story that brings people the more emotional tears than any other stories in there. And it usually starts out, well, you get what you deserve when you dodge the draft. But my cousin Bradley, who was named after World War II General Omar Bradley, who was the successful military person, both he and Rusty tried to put their lives together after the war, and you know, we heard a lot about the war that was not complimentary of our country and our time. But again, that's important stuff to put out. And Rusty had two children and lived in Florida and ended up dying of results of intravenous drug use that he had picked up while a habit he picked up while in Canada. And then Bradley ended up spending most of his life, adult life, he had a wife and a child, but spending up most of his life in veterans hospitals because he really could never come to terms with what he dealt with in the war. He ended up dying about the same time Rusty did. I think one died at the age of 52 and the other died at age 54. I never dug into the reason, but it was pretty much said to be a suicide. And the chapter ends with a letter of Bradley writing a letter to Bradley's father, writing a letter to Rusty's mother saying, you know, I'm very proud of my military career and all that I did, but there are some certain things I did during the Vietnam era, which he now calls the Vietnam era, which I wish I hadn't done. And those are lessons learned. And I recently found a quote from Benjamin Franklin when they were writing the Constitution. He said, we all must question authority. So I framed it on my wall with all my other collections. Again, it's an ugly story, but it's a story of family, and a story of family during a terribly troubled time. We'll all read about Vietnam and the mistakes made and during that growth history for our country. But at the same time, if we don't share those stories, we don't write those stories, we don't say those letters, we're not going to hear the human side of those stories on both sides of the issue.
Well, and I'm glad you told that story. That was one of my, as dark as it was one of my favorites because I didn't see it coming. I first started reading about Bradley, I thought, wow, this is just a contrast of, you know, what families were dealing with. And then to hear what his demise at the end, it was like, wow. So this, in many ways, this war had destroyed two lives, but in two totally different ways. I'm glad you brought that one up. That was a very good one. Well, all right.
I had to pry those letters out of their parents. I mean, they're all in their 90s now, and they were not sure about it. And I said, this story has to be told.
No,
I wouldn't have written the book if I had not gotten that story.
Really? Well, that makes sense because it was like, again, it snuck up on me. I had no idea that that's the way Bradley's life would take a turn. And that was not unusual for those guys. Well, Mark, dude, this has been a blast. I mean, now,
now we've got to figure out. I hope the next conversation is going to be whenever you've either sold the, as a matter of fact, you know, there's, so Joe Newcomb, who is a friend of mine, I was actually about to help produce a movie, and I got to meet this guy named Joe Newcomb, who is one of the nicest guys on earth. He was one of the main financiers of Dallas Buyers Club. First movie the guy ever finances becomes an Academy Award winning movie that changed Matthew McConaughey's life. And he actually has a studio there in Austin. And I'm thinking that I need to introduce you to Joe Newcomb, and we need to sell this as a series, man. I mean, I hope that's the next conversation we have, is that Netflix or Prime picked it up.
As long as God gets the glory.
Amen, brother. Well, I love it. And so where can people find out more about the Shoebox Chronicles? Where are you? What's your social media, Facebook, anything you want to share so that people can dive in and learn more about this?
Well, the best place, because I have everything, including my cell phone on there, is www.marklehman-writer.com. Marklehman-writer.com. And I would start there. The book is available on numerous sources. It is in most Target stores right now, but I've sent several people to Target and they were sold out or couldn't find it. So I'm still referring people to purchase it through Amazon.com. They have a very quick delivery service, and I'm just so humbled that people are reading the book and enjoying the book and getting something out of it, because that was my goal.
Well, it's awesome. And for those of you watching on the YouTube channel, there it is. There's the book, The Shoebox Chronicles, by my friend, my dear friend, Mark Lehman, man.
By the way, that actually is the shoebox in the original letters that I found.
Oh, really? Oh, let me pull it back up.
That's it.
That's not just something they found on Canva, huh? That's awesome.
No, that's the letters, and
that's so cool.
I'm so glad I say that. I mean, that thing came from within one hair of being thrown away.
Wow, that is so cool. Well, brother, all right. So like I told you, I was doing something new, so I'm going to stop recording on all three places. Sit tight, and I want to say goodbye properly, so bear with me. But before I do that, if you're watching on the YouTube channel, thank you so much for checking out The Jason Wright Show with me and my friend Mark Lehman. Go buy this book. I told Mark before we got on, this is a book that I am most definitely going to be giving as a gift this Christmas. It is a great, great chronicle, as the title would indicate, of not just Mark's family, but of all of our families. We can all relate to it. It's a terrific read, so I highly suggest it. And with that, as I say, always go out, improve always and always, and thank you so much for tuning into The Jason Wright Show. I'm Jason Wright. I'm out. Well, that does it for yet another episode of The Jason Wright Show. This has been a Texas Titans Media production. Fourth Wall, handle the audio. Those guys crush it. Thank you, boys. I appreciate your work, the Harden brothers. And remember, whatever you do, between now and the next episode of The Jason Wright Show, go out and endeavor to improve always in all ways. And one of the ways you can find out what I'm doing to always do just that very thing is to go to jasonwrightnow.com and subscribe to the Vitruvian Letter. That is where I document my most recent biohacks, things I'm reading, things I'm experimenting with, scientific research that I'm looking into to figure out how I, yours truly, your host, Jason Wright, can and will always endeavor to improve always in all ways. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm out.